In the basement, a bottle of Coca-Cola is levitated. Oh, come on. Like magicians, there's some hidden string. I'm just reading it, friends. Throughout the house, bottles would rise into the air, their caps unscrewed with themselves, and the contents would spill. The hi-fi amplifier at left was part of the second sound system to be destroyed by the infesting entities. See, it's all ripped out and destroyed. When this picture was taken, the recreation room sofa cushions had just been dematerialized. A few hours later, they were found in a closet. Furniture levitating during a demonic rampage in the basement recreation room. See, how'd they get these pictures? They were there to exorcise the house. In Lorraine Warren's presence, Brian Donovan's bedroom doors dematerialized. They were later found on the cellar stairs as photographed. These dematerializations would happen in absolute silence. Physical objects would simply be there 1 minute, gone the next. Here the shoes on the floor had been in storage and for some strange reason were placed in this ostensibly walking position. You may say to me, do you believe this? I don't know. I'm just searching like you. My normal instinct is to say it's a crock. An absolute crock. But I also know the respect these people have. I'd believe them for it, believe a bureaucrat. The recreation room lamp being levitated. Ten minutes before, the room had been in perfect order. Note the plastic garbage can levitating upside down over the pile of furniture. When this photograph was taken, pandemonium was occurring throughout the whole house. And there's the garbage pail levitating. The first time the Warrens visited the Donovan home, Ed inspected the damage done to the basement recreation room. When he climbed back upstairs to the first floor, these bottles of bleach and detergent floated along behind him. Their caps were removed by unseen hands and their contents spilled on the cellar stairs. Now, we'll read about the Donovans, which is the background of this story, if you're interested. I'm looking at a book, The Demonologist, by Gerald Brittle. It's the extraordinary career of Ed and Lorraine Warren. These are not a couple of nuts. The superintendent or commandant of West Point called them in to deal with what might be called a ghost situation. The Amityville horror, they were the experts on demonology called in. When a home, the Donovan home, began to be terrorized until they were brought to the point of near insanity by strange happenings in their home, Ed and Lorraine Warren were called in. Now, the only reason I throw this around is it's useful here. It isn't useful anywhere. It isn't useful everywhere. When it's useful, I mention it. Not to give me anything other than a little bit of credibility as a non-nut. Now, I dress rather casual, so nobody will take me for a television evangelist. When I'm on this subject, I have to remind you, I did a PhD at Stanford University in philosophies of education. But I don't have a closed mind. And I think it's time that intelligent people look at the subject of demonology and parapsychology. You can't ignore a man like Nostradamus. You can't ignore a man like Edgar Cayce. Jean Dixon's pretty good, but she can't hold a candle to Edgar Cayce or Nostradamus. Too cold in here now, Mike. Can't you find something in between? Now, we just joined Dallas, Fort Worth, Memphis. We've got a lot of other cities with us. And I'm reading. while they were working on the Amityville Horror case, they had a visitation at their house. Will I bore you as I lead up to it again? In an earlier hour, we were looking at automatism, where in a seance like, they call them sitters, seance like sitting, you receive communications from somewhere, claimed, and you write them. Bly and Allen, ostracized with the Anglican Church in 1907 in an automatism, received communication from a monk, Johann, who died in 1533. What's significant is they received information from him about a giant chapel adjunct to Glastonbury Abbey, and they were ostracized for such witchery. Except archaeologists in later years dug it up in every detail. And old Johann was right. He died in 1533. While working on the Amityville Horror case, Ed Warren was in his office. Ed Warren's office, located in a small cottage size. There's no way I can pick this up without laying the foundation. You understand that? Stay with me, you that have heard it. Ed Memphis weren't even with us yesterday. Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage. Now, I don't want to get anybody scared. Greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. Faith and formula conquer the devil. And faith, 90% courage. Fear invites him in. The formula is the power of Jesus' name. Any of you ever see the TV series on Masada? Remember when the guy from Caesar showed up with that little paper in his hand with the seal of Caesar on it? When he waved that, he was Caesar. That was his authority when he arrived at Masada. The seal of Caesar on that document made him the extension of Caesar. He was Caesar there. Jesus' name gives you authority. The problem with most Christians, they don't realize that the warfare is really against principalities and powers, and wickedness in high places. But we're studying Atlantis, the pyramid, the Bermuda Triangle, the 35th parallel of the Azores, and we're not closing our mind to the supernatural. Okay? And instead of approaching demonology the way some do, I decided to introduce you to a Catholic demonologist, a layman demonologist. Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage-sized building. Now, he was making the devil mad, if the devil exists, by what he was doing at the Amityville horror situation. Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage-sized building attached to the main house by a long enclosed passageway. As Ed sat working on preliminary details of the Amityville case that fateful February morning, the latch at the end of the passageway snapped open, followed by the percussive boom of the heavy wooden door. Footsteps then started toward the office. Ed leaned back in his chair, waiting for Lorraine, his wife, to enter with a much-needed cup of coffee. "In here," Ed Warren called out. Long moments passed, however. She didn't appear. "Lorraine!" Ed called out again, but there was no reply. What he heard instead, building in the distance, was an eerie, howling wind. It was not the whistling of wind under the eaves, but rather the menacing roar of a distant cyclone. Goose flesh rose on his arms. "Lorraine!" he asked forcefully. "Are you there?" Still, no response. As the ominous swirling sound built in power and intensity, Ed quickly thought back over the last few seconds. It then occurred to him that he had heard only three footsteps in the passageway, not the continuous tread of a person walking. Something was wrong. Suddenly, the desk lamp dimmed to the strength of a candle flame, then abruptly the temperature in the office plunged to that of a walk-in freezer. A rank, pungent smell of sulfur rose in the room. Suspicious of the unnatural clamor, Ed Warren opened a desk drawer and withdrew a vial of holy water and a large wooden crucifix. He then got up and walked a few steps out of his office into the anteroom. As he did, there swirled out of the passageway a horrendous, conical whirlwind. Pointed at the bottom, broad at the top, the thing was blacker than the natural blackness of night. Far larger than a man, the swirling black mass moved into the dimly lit room and drifted slowly to Ed's left side and came to a halt some 10 feet away. As Ed watched, it appeared to grow even denser and blacker than it was before. Indeed, within the swirl, he could see that something was beginning to take shape. An entity was beginning to manifest in physical form. As a demonologist, Ed Warren knew he had to act quickly to take the initiative before this fearsome black mass transformed itself into something even more forbidding and dangerous. Holding the cross toward what was now rapidly changing into the macabre hooded specter, Ed Warren stepped forward. The moment he did, however, the entity moved defiantly toward him. Ed stopped, stood his ground as the form slowly drifted forward. When the swirling black mass was no more than a few feet away, Ed methodically and with absolute determination showered the thing in the sign of the cross with the contents of the holy water vial. Then he spoke the ancient command, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave." For eternal seconds, the black mass stayed motionless, no more than a foot away from the cross. Then slowly, it began to back off, though not before giving Ed a clear vision of himself and Lorraine involved in a potentially deadly automobile accident along a highway. Leaving that dreadful vision, the entity withdrew into the passageway from whence it came. An enormous sense of relief came over Ed Warren as he stood, sweating profusely in the freezing, cold room. "Are you going to think I'm a nut for introducing you to this subject? I mean, there's one subject I don't have to teach on. You can just go on glibly through life unaware of any of this. It's okay if that's what you want. And you don't think I'm a nut?" An enormous sense of relief came over Ed Warren as he stood sweating profusely in the freezing cold room. Yet, as he attempted to collect his thoughts, the vicious snarl of fighting animals suddenly erupted outside the house. Immediately, Ed realized there were no animals fighting. The visitation was still in progress. The entity had simply moved upstairs to attack Lorraine, his wife. Avoiding the passageway, Ed flung open the side door to the office and ran up the back steps of the house. He would be too late. Upstairs, Lorraine Warren sat in bed reading. No matter how exhausted, Lorraine nevertheless will not sleep when Ed must work alone late at nights in the office. After a lifetime of work in the supernatural, both Ed and Lorraine Warren know that they are never alone, ever. As Lorraine sat quietly reading, a dreadful pall swept over the room. You know, some of my enemies just get to believing and convincing themselves that I don't believe in the supernatural. And here I go blowing them asunder. I don't believe in nuts. I don't believe in overrating the devil. I don't believe in cheap substitutes for revival and the supernatural moves of God. And I don't believe in silly claims about the devil. I don't think he hides in backward messages and records. And if he does, that ain't important enough for me to waste time on. I don't play records backwards. But I believe that the realm of the parapsychological, the realm of the preternatural, the realm of the supernatural ought to be considered by intelligent people. As Lorraine sat quietly reading, a dreadful pall swept over the room. Did you ever feel anything like that? It's too hot in here, Mike. Then, setting the book down, she too realized that something was wrong. Very wrong. I was terror-stricken, she says, but I didn't know what I was afraid of. I looked around the room, but nothing was there. I looked down at our two dogs asleep by the bed. They were absolutely motionless, except the hair on each dog from head to tail was standing straight up in the air. Run that one by again. I was terror-stricken, Lorraine recalls, but I didn't know what I was afraid of. I looked around the room, but nothing was there. I then looked down at our two dogs asleep beside the bed. They were absolutely motionless. Remember when some guys took on demons in the Bible? And they yelled out at them. Jesus, we know, and Father, we know, but who are you? Or I watched some of those demon deliverers a few years back, or having them spit them out on napkins. I used to wonder what kind of speed records the deliverer would set if one of those gobs of spit materialized into a real demon. I was terror-stricken, Lorraine recalls, but I didn't know what I was afraid of. I looked around the room, but nothing was there. I then looked down at our two dogs asleep beside the bed. I'd kill those dogs for sleeping. Sleeping through this? Well, I wouldn't kill them. I like dogs too much, but I'd give them away. How could those two dogs sleep through this? Watch dogs. They're like Jesus' disciples, just watch and pray, and they sleep. watchdogs. I looked down at our two dogs asleep beside the bed. They were absolutely motionless, except the hair on each dog from head to tail was standing straight up in the air. Ought to kick me a dog and said, "Look at your hair." Then out of nowhere, complete pandemonium started up. The swirling black entity that Ed had repelled only a minute before had apparently moved back through the passageway and into the house. The horrendous invader announced its arrival by producing a thunderous pounding noise that sounded to Lorraine like someone beating on sheet metal with a hammer. The violent bashing sound jolted her. Then, within seconds, the heat was totally drawn from the room, leaving Lorraine quaking in the cold. After that, the terrible pounding stopped, and she too heard the swirling sound of the whirlwind coming toward her. What are them damn dogs doing? Through all that pounding. I'd give those dogs to a TV evangelist. They were mine. The menacing, ungodly noise came from the direction of the passageway, one floor below. Terrified, she listened as the whirlwind came up the stairs and swirled into the kitchen, then the dining room, then the living room. Whatever was out there seemed to be searching for me, says Lorraine. What was it? Why was it here? Then instantly, that's where we were, wasn't it? Right there. Whatever was out there seemed to be searching for me, says Lorraine. What was it? Why was it here? Then instantly, a now, I tell you what, I'd like to finish this tonight because I'm tired of reading the introduction. I found myself getting mad at the dogs tonight. It was October 1972. The executive officer at the United States Military Academy telephoned the Warrens a day before they were scheduled to present a general lecture to the cadets there. Though the officer's comments were deliberately vague, he nonetheless told the Warrens that a curious security problem had arisen. This is the commandant of West Point, October 1972. Calling the Warrens in to solve a problem. When they arrive there, to skip along, "We'll be glad to help," Ed replied. "Do you know the nature of the problem?" Between us, the major almost broke into a grin. "There's a ghost in the general's quarters. I read to you last night the general's speech. He says nothing macabre has happened here. Nevertheless, a number of incidents have gone on in this house that so far no one has been able to explain to my satisfaction. Some background. In the basement, there's a private study. That room is kept locked and secure. No matter how many times the bunk in there is made up, it's always found ripped apart. Later. Upstairs, ghosts have been seen flitting around the house. These I haven't seen, the general said, but they've been reported for years, and apparently they go with the billet. Now, I wouldn't mention any of this except that we've had an unusual persistent problem. Personal belongings and other important articles are regularly found missing, not stolen," he emphasized, "but missing temporarily. The general stopped for a moment to put on his glasses. Hey, this is not a paid miracle actor at a two-bit sensationalist show. This is a commanding general of West Point. The general stopped for a moment to put on his glasses. I grant you, he says, none of this is terribly important unless you put it into perspective. One of the responsibilities of the commanding officer here is social protocol. In this house, we receive our fair share of government leaders and army brass. Recently, on special occasions, some potentially serious events have occurred. Wallets have been stolen, pockets have been picked, money and personal mementos have been taken from eminent dignitaries and their wives. Later, all the stolen items are found upstairs, neatly laid out on the dresser in our master bedroom. The Warrens sat mum, taking in the unique nature of the problem. This foolishness, the general said in forceful tones, cannot continue. Yet we know that no person has committed these actions. So my question to you, Mr. Warren or Mrs. Warren, is the following. If this is a ghost, and I stress if it is, then you tell me, can a ghost manipulate physical objects? Yes, Ed answered. It can, providing the objects are of no significant weight, such as the ones you describe. All right, then, the general said, does this sound like a ghost to you? Based on what you say, Ed answered. Yes. In fact, it's quite probable that a human spirit is at work here because the items did not disappear completely. Taken aback by the reply, the general looked at Ed for a moment. I guess like he's seeing a ghost. Would you be able to tell if there's a ghost in this house that steals wallets? Lorraine saw this as her opportunity to reply. Sir? Now, I only read that to let you know. I'll get back to it. But these are not nuts. What's your explanation of this? Now, throughout most of my life, I doubt everything. I didn't even believe in God for 3.5 years. I wasn't sure he wasn't there, but I wasn't sure he was either. I mean, I am a hardhead. My first instinct is to say, this is a bunch of crock. But let's pursue it a bit and see. We'll see, won't we? Reading from The Demonologist by Gerald Brittle, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren. You say you believe everything in that book? I seldom believe everything in any book. I even research how we got our Bible. But I think this deserves attention, if your nerves can take it. Upstairs, Lorraine Warren sat in bed reading. As Lorraine sat quietly reading, a dreadful pall swept over the room. Then, setting the book down, she too realized something was wrong. Very wrong. I was terror-stricken, Lorraine recalls. But I didn't know what I was afraid of. I looked around the room, but nothing was there. I then looked down at our two dogs asleep beside the bed. They were absolutely motionless, except the hair on each dog. Remember that movie, Patton? When he took that pit bull to that woman's gathering there in France, and that little Pekingese or whatever it was barking, and George C. Scott playing Patton's place, looked at his aide and sort of smiled that that pit bull was going to tear that other little dog to pieces. Remember that scene? and the pit bull started whimpering. These are his descendants. I looked down at our two dogs asleep beside the bed. They were absolutely motionless, except the hair on each dog, from head to tail, was standing straight up in the air. Then out of nowhere, complete pandemonium started up. The swirling black entity that Ed had repelled only minutes before had apparently moved back through the passageway and into the house. The horrendous invader announced its arrival by producing a thunderous, pounding noise that sounded to Lorraine like someone beating on sheet metal with a hammer. The violent, bashing sound jolted her, then within seconds the heat was totally drawn from the room, leaving Lorraine quaking in the cold. After that, the terrible pounding stopped, and she too heard the swirling sound of a whirlwind coming toward her. The menacing, ungodly noise came from the direction of the passageway one floor below. Terrified, she listened as the whirlwind came up the stairs and swirled into the kitchen, then the dining room, then the living room. "Whatever was out there seemed to be searching for me," says Lorraine. "What was it? Why was it here?" Then instantly a swirling black cyclone flew into the bedroom and confronted me. I went right past the stopping point. You didn't even notice. I could not begin to relate the sheer, desperate terror I felt as that morbid black thing inside the whirlwind came closer and closer to me. I tried to move, but I couldn't. I tried to scream, but no words came out. I felt a sense of doom then that I've never felt before. As a psychic, I knew this was a spirit of death, but it seemed to want even more than death. It wanted me, myself, my being. Then it got worse. Lorraine continues, "I felt myself being drawn into that raging black thing, and there was nothing I could do to prevent it. Mechanically, I did the only thing I could think of. I called out in the name of God for protection. Then somehow I got the ability to make a cross." These are Catholic demonologists. "A great big cross in the air between it and me. That stopped the thing. But it wouldn't go away. I didn't know what to do next. At that point, thank God, Ed came running into the house. As he did, this thing swirled into the next room, went right through the bricks and up the chimney. Then it was over. Nothing was broken, nothing was smashed. Nevertheless, this was not our first physical encounter with an inhuman spirit." What confronted Ed and Lorraine Warren in those early morning hours was not a ghost, nor was it something seen only by them. The same swirling black mass had been reported by others. Rather, this was the appearance of something far more ominous than a ghost could ever be, the manifestation of a comparatively rare phenomenon known as an inhuman demonic spirit, a preternatural entity. The inhuman spirit is considered to be possessed of a negative, diabolical intelligence fixed in a perpetual rage against both man and God. What this spirit is, what it can do, and what its existence ultimately portends is the work and concern of the demonologist. Until recently, few except other professionals and the exorcist clergy knew much about Ed and Lorraine Warren. Their work, by necessity, was not public. Instead, The Warrens remain in the background, either working privately with individuals experiencing true spirit-related problems or as investigators performing on-site research where strange or unusual phenomena were in progress. The Warrens began investigating spirit phenomena in the mid-1940s, but not until the 1970s did they really come into public view. Wherever bizarre or ominous activity took place, it seemed the Warrens were always there. In 1972, for example, the ghost of a 19th-century manservant became active in the superintendent's mansion at West Point and began harassing guests of the commanding general. It was the Warrens, the New York papers later reported, whom the Army called in to confront this rogue spirit and put a stop to its antics. Early in 1974, the Warrens were again in the public eye. This time, they were briefly seen at the conclusion of a case where exorcism by a Roman Catholic priest had to be performed in a home that was being plundered by invisible vandals that were even attacking people. Later in the year, the Warrens were again in the news, this time on network television, when a home in southern New England was rocked by some of the most incredible poltergeist activity on record. The cause of the disturbances in both cases, Ed said knowingly, was demonic. But not until 1976, when they were brought in to investigate reports of yet another outbreak of demoniacal activity in Amityville, was national attention fully trained on Ed and Lorraine Warren and their extraordinary work in the field of supernatural phenomena. Who are these two people seen in the background of news photographs but hardly ever identified? What are they like, and why do they do the kind of work they do? Ed Warren was born in Connecticut in September 1926. Burly, barrel-chested, and good-natured, Ed looks more like a corner grocer than a demonologist. Distinctly unpretentious, Ed gives no clue to the mysterious knowledge and power he carries with him. Calm and easygoing, he exudes the air of confidence one finds in people who have learned what they know the hard way. Lorraine Warren, born a scant few miles from her future husband in January 1927, is slim and attractive, with an ever-ready smile. Judging from her appearance, that of a fashionable New England housewife, one would never assume that she is a penetrating, clairvoyant, and light trance medium. And as this Catholic wife is characterized, Lorraine is endowed with a biblical gift of discernment of spirits, which St. Paul spoke of in 1st Epistle to the Corinthians. Maybe. Let me stop you there. There's only one gift in the Scripture. That's the gift of the Spirit. If any man has not the Spirit of Christ, he's none of his. Now, your theology sometimes is forgiven by God as you approach Him. But let me give you some philosophic premises. Wherever God is, if He's a person, wherever God is, that person is absolutely there. You don't get God like water into a bottle. Pour a little bit in, and a little more, and then a little more. No matter how we may describe it, the deposit of God's life is complete in and of itself. Now, the good news of the gospel in the New Testament, the theological position of another kind of righteousness other than the striving and achieving to match a standard that cannot bend, is the righteousness that is from faith to faith and is a gift of God. The deposit in us of a life no stranger than the little unit of energy in a nuclear sub. The deposit of God's life in us no stranger and weird than Christ's life coming forth from that tomb through a rock, through a door, and sailing away. That's why the resurrection is the fundamental premise of Christianity. Once you cross that hurdle, you can believe the rest. My problem is I couldn't believe the resurrection. If I could believe that He came out of that tomb, through that rock, through that door, and sailed off in the blue, I can believe the rest. Molecular displacement's nothing to him. I'm not physics trained to know that what looks solid isn't. That it's impossible to tell where you begin and where outside of you ends, and vice versa. We've developed photographic ability now to film the aura of chemical and electric energy around each of us. So where do you begin and where do you end? We're more space than we are, quote, substance. And whatever we call substance is more space than substance. And you just keep getting it down, down, down. Philosophically, you can never settle the issue. It divides the whole world epistemologically between those who believe things consist in and of relationships, and that's all there is, and those that believe entities are there having relationships. But the premise of Christianity is that for faith, not because you earn it by being so perfect that the house is clean enough for the king, as the gift of God for trusting faith in his word, he puts his life in us. And when the Spirit comes, he brings with himself all of his qualities. Spirituality is nothing more nor less than the expressions of the Spirit. It's that life in us finding an outlet, being itself, being himself, literally. Now, there needs to be a distinction drawn between the natural ability of a parapsychic, the supernatural ability, which can come from two sources, maybe a third, but certainly from two. Divine spiritual action, evil spiritual action. But what some people fail to recognize is that there are natural parapsychological traits. And some people who are born with extrasensory traits make a mistake of attributing that to the Corinthian letters, gift of the Spirit. That gift of the Spirit in the Corinthian letter is God's gift in response to faith. That's an additive. But I've come totally to believe, and when I was in early years of university, parapsychological studies in respected universities in America was just maturing. The general attitude in the materialistic world and the limited naturalism of the thinking of scientists in the day was that it didn't happen. There was a natural explanation for it. Not so anymore. The evidence is so piled up under controlled experiments that it's no longer a question as to whether or not extrasensory perception occurs or parapsychological phenomenon happen. The question is how, and maybe why, but it does occur. Some people are born with that gift. Now, I have my own explanation for it. I can't prove it, don't know if it's true. But I know there are traits carried in the recessive genes